You are now tuned in to the Eagle Sports Zone.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another great edition of the Eagle Sports Zone. As per usual, I am your host, Hende. And I will be with you until 8 p.m. this evening on this chilly evening here in the capital, coming to you live from our studio in Windhoek. You are tuning into Eagle FM, Namibia's number one talk radio station. And this is another great edition of the Eagle Sports Zone. As usual, you can tune into us via traditional frequency, or you can tune into us via our mobile application. That is the Eagle FM mobile application that is free to download right now. You can download on the Google Play Store or on the Apple App Store. Cost you a total of $0 and 0 Namibian cents. Alternatively, you can also tune into us via our website. That's www.eaglefm.com.na. And you know, if you happen to miss your favorite program on Eagle FM, whatever time of the year, the day, whenever that program occurred, if it aired live here on Eagle FM, you will be able to catch up and listen to it in our podcast section that is both on the website and the Eagle FM mobile application. And of course, we are also live right now on Facebook, on YouTube, on X. So if you want to send us any questions, any comments, any concerns, anything you want to share about anything in sport, really. But today we're talking about the World Cup and Africa's involvement in the 2026 FIFA World Cup. Africa's historic involvement in this 2026 FIFA World Cup. Alternatively, the number in the studio is also 083-288-401. That's 083-288-401. If you'd like to call into the studio with any questions, comments, concerns, anything you want to share. Maybe you're a Bafana supporter. You're excited for what's going to happen tonight against Canada in the round of 32. But ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of the Eagle Sports Zone. And before we get into our topic for the day, we are going to discuss some local sporting news as we always do here on the Eagle Sports Zone. And we will begin the Eagle Sports Zone with, you know, staying on topic for the day, that is football, local football that is. We will be going to the NFA Cup that concluded over the weekend, where we had UNAM FC up against KK Palace on the men's side of things. And the clever boys, that is UNAM, took that 2-1, being crowned as the 2026 NFA Cup champions. They beat KK Palace 2-1 and walking away with a $400,000 cash prize. KK Palace, as runners-up, received $200,000 in cash prize. Finishing in third place was Okanja United, and they received a payout of $100,000. They beat Mighty Gunners on penalties. That is 10-9. They beat them on penalties. So if you're a supporter of any of those four teams that I mentioned, call in, comment on Facebook, comment on YouTube, comment on X. Let me know how you feel about how your team did this year in the NFA Cup. On the ladies' side of things, the Mighty Gunners ladies, who finished second in the FNB Women's Super League, they got some silverware this year. And that is the NFA Cup. On the women's side of things, they beat Comas Nampol ladies 4-0 in the final, winning $150,000. The Comas Nampol ladies, who finished second, walked away with $70,000. And then Julinho Athletics, their ladies claimed the bronze medal and walked away with $40,000 in cash prize. Now, you know, there we can see the clear discrepancy in the prize money between the men's and women's game. So the women's game still on the rise, but hopefully, you know, next year, starting next year already, we will get to a point where the prize money is equal. You know, there's a few leagues and there's a few national team setups where that has been implemented, where the men and women earn the same amount of money. I mean, we could do a whole show on prize money discrepancies between men's and women's sports, especially for team sports, but that's a topic for another day. But I personally am of the opinion that they should 100% be equal, but it's a gradual process. We'll get there. So in terms of individual prizes on the ladies' side of things, We had Mighty Gunners goalkeeper Melissa Matthews. She won the goalkeeper of the tournament, walking away with a $10,000 cash prize. Then the player of the tournament went to Alina Aluendo, also from the Mighty Gunners. She walked away with a $15,000 in cash prize. Moving along, we go to rugby, where a developmental side, so to say, that is the Velvicias Invitational 15s. They beat Zambia in an international rugby fixture over at the Hagigin Cup Stadium here in Windhoek with a resounding score of 71-12. So very confident performance from our boys playing in the Velvicia side, taking care of business against Zambia. And on the some continental news, we had our very own long distance runner, famous long distance runner, that is Lavinia Haitope. She successfully defended her Nelson Mandela Bay half marathon title, delivering yet another great performance this year to retain her title as champion. This was on a Saturday morning over in South Africa. So huge congratulations. A huge congratulations to Miss Lavinia for representing the nation well when it comes to running. And then we have more round of applause to give out. That is to a young lady. That is Miss Juanivia Besaidenon. She was crowned the ITF World Under 18 J30 Doubles Champion over in Lusaka. That is in Zambia, in tennis. So she claimed another title to add to her growing tennis, trophy cabinet. And then in athletics, on the athletic side of things, we had some youngsters representing the nation well. That is in athletics, with Joshua Titus winning silver for Team Namibia in the boys under 19,500 meter event that is at the World Youth Games over in Gothenburg, Sweden. All the way in Scandinavia doing well. And then on the ladies side of things, we had Miss Lalik Adam, who won the gold medal in the girls under 14 shot put event that is also at the World Youth Games in Gothenburg, Sweden. So a round of applause to our young athletes representing the nation well, all the way in Sweden. Now, ladies and gentlemen, today on the Eagle Sports Zone, as I promised, we are here to discuss Africa's incredible performance so far at the 2026 FIFA World Cup. If you were listening to the Eagle Sports Zone maybe a week or two ago, 2 weeks ago, we discussed a topic that I received mixed reviews to. And that is the lack of African merchandise on the streets and on the shelves of Namibia, in Windhoek in particular. I can't speak for the other towns, but I'm confident that what happens in Windhoek happens in the rest of the country. So in that article, I discussed some of the reasons as to why, we live in Africa, but all the merchandise, all the teams that we can support in the stores is all European stores. I mean, there's German flags in abundance, there's Argentinian flags in abundance, Brazilian flags in abundance, French flags in abundance, not Italian, they didn't qualify. I saw England flags in abundance, and obviously South Africa as well, knowing that most of our shops come from there, so it's natural that we have South African apparel here. But my whole point of the article was, why don't we have African merchandise available in Africa, in the SADC region, where we have two countries representing us at the FIFA, at this year's FIFA World Cup, that is South Africa and DR Congo. South Africa explained why we have their apparel here. So on, out of the 10 countries, at the very least, we have one that is our neighbor, South Africa. But that one is kind of by force almost. But DR Congo, who have been making history at this World Cup, first World Cup appearance since 1974, first time qualifying to the knockout stage, first goals that they're scoring at the World Cup, first win at the World Cup. And I'm sure many football lovers have fallen in love with this side. But it is close to impossible for me as a football fan to be able to go into the stores and find DR Congo apparel. And in the opinion here of the Eagle Sports Zone, it shouldn't be that way. We should have this kind of apparel in abundance. But, you know, we did a whole show on that. So if you'd like to listen to that, simply go to the podcast section of the Eagle FM website and the Eagle FM mobile application, and you will be able to dive into that conversation. And you can read the article as well on the Villager website. That is www.thevillager.com.na. So we'll take a brief look at Africa's participation in the 2026 in the FIFA World Cup in general. We'll look at how Africa has done since the 1930 World Cup. When was the first time Africa participated at the World Cup? What's the furthest Africa has gone at the World Cup? And we'll tie it all together with what's happening now. So before we get into that, I would like to reiterate, this is a historic World Cup for Africa, right? It's the first time ever that we're having 10 teams in the FIFA World Cup. Of course, this is an expanded format of the World Cup. The World Cup is usually only 32 teams. But this year, since 1998, actually, it's been 32 teams. The World Cup started with only 13 teams. Then it moved to 16. Then it moved to 24 teams. And then in 1998, they said, let's make it 32 teams. And now, and for the foreseeable future, it will be 48 teams, which is why now we have more teams from everywhere else in the world, but Africa in particular participating at the World Cup. So it's the first time Africa is this well represented at the World Cup. And then what happens when Africa is this well represented at the World Cup? 9 of the 10 teams advance to the knockout stage of the World Cup. Something we've never seen before, ever. You know, we have teams like Cape Verde. First time in the World Cup. What do? Qualify for the knockout stage. DR Congo, essentially their first time in the World Cup. What do? They win, they score goals, and they qualify to the knockout stages for the very first time. South Africa qualifies to the knockout stage for the very first time. Believe it or not, Ivory Coast qualifies for the knockout stage for the very first time. Egypt, you know, intuitively one would think we see Egypt as a powerhouse on the continent, but it's also their first time qualifying for the knockout stage at the World Cup. Cape Verde, I mentioned. So plenty of history being made in that front. But I would want to talk about now, when is the first time Africa participated at the FIFA World Cup? The very first time was in the second World Cup, actually. That is 1934. Egypt participated in that World Cup. They didn't do well. But between 1934 and 1966, the year that England won the World Cup for the first and only time. And it was also the only year, surprisingly as well, that they hosted the World Cup. But I digress. That was the second World Cup where African nation participated at the World Cup. That is 1970, excuse me, not 1966, 1970. That World Cup that was hosted in Mexico. And the nation that participated then was Morocco. Then 1974, that is when Zaire, today known as DR Congo, participated in the World Cup. And then from then on, 1978, again, we only had one representative. That was Tunisia, who didn't do well at this World Cup at all. Then we moved to 1982. From 1982 until 2026, Africa has had at least two representatives or more at the World Cup. So it started in 1982 when we had Cameroon and Algeria. Then in 1986, we had Morocco and Algeria. 1990, we had Cameroon and Egypt. And then from 1994 onwards, it was minimum three or more. So it began with Cameroon, Morocco, and Nigeria. Then went on and on and on and on. And then, excluding the 2026 FIFA World Cup, the most number of teams that we've had at a World Cup was in 2010. That was primarily due to, of course, South Africa being hosts. So it was South Africa plus 5 other nations, which were Cameroon, Nigeria, Algeria, Ghana, and Cote d'Ivoire. So, when it comes to the African nation that's made it the furthest at the World Cup, as you may or may not know, that was Morocco in the previous World Cup. You know, the team that some say are the Brazilians of Africa. They had a stellar World Cup, finishing fourth, actually, at the 2022 FIFA World Cup over in Qatar. And some more of our best finishers include Morocco as well, reaching the round of 16 in 1986. Cameroon reaching the quarterfinals in 1990. Nigeria have reached the round of 16 in 1994, 98, and 2014. Senegal, who made history at this World Cup by becoming the first African country to score 5 goals at a FIFA World Cup when they beat Iraq 5-0 to advance to the round of 32 as one of the best third place finishers. They finished, their best finish was a quarterfinal in 2002, which is the same World Cup where they famously beat France in the group stages. Then we had, they also made it to the round of 16. Obviously in 2002 as well. Then Ghana, their best finishes were a quarterfinal in 2006, quarterfinal in 2020, and Algeria, their best finish was a round of 16 in 2014. So other than that, what we're experiencing today, and hopefully Bafana Bafana will make more history tonight by reaching the quarterfinals, as they the round of 16, excuse me. This is their first time reaching the knockout stages. So with the expanded World Cup comes an additional round of knockout fixtures. So more history that Africa has made at this World Cup. There's no continent has qualified more countries to the knockout stage than Africa. As we know, Africa, 90%, 9 out of 10 teams have qualified for the knockout stages. The only team that didn't qualify from the 10 that made it was Tunisia, who, by their standards, had a had an abysmal World Cup, so bad that they had to fire their coach after the first match. But to give you some perspective, Europe, 81% of their teams qualified for the knockout stages. That's 13 out of 16 teams. Asia, only 22% of their teams qualified for the knockout stage. That's 2 out of 9 teams. North America, that's 3 out of 6 teams, 50% of their teams qualified for the knockout stages. And South America, 5 of their 6 teams, which works out to 83%, qualified for the knockout stages. And then Oceania, or Australia, depending on who you ask, they qualified 0 of the one teams participating. So adding on to you know, Africa's historic participation and contribution to this 2026 FIFA World Cup, we'll take it back to the qualifiers, where Italy's head coach.
Großartige Neuigkeiten. Imba ist jetzt noch besser geworden. Wir haben brandneue Funktionen hinzugefügt, um dein Erlebnis noch reibungsloser, schneller und leistungsstärker zu machen als je zuvor. Bereit, das volle Potenzial von Imba freizuschalten? Erhalte alle exklusiven Funktionen für nur 36 Namibia-Dollar pro Monat. Oder spare noch mehr mit unseren speziellen Abonnementplänen. 5% Rabatt bei einem 3-Monats-Abonnement, 10% Rabatt bei einem 6-Monats-Abonnement oder 25% Rabatt bei einem 12-Monats-Abonnement. Wähle den Plan, der am besten zu dir passt und genieße alles, was Imba zu bieten hat, zu einem unschlagbaren Preis. Imba, where the world congregates. Lade es herunter und abonniere noch heute.
Eagle FM, good evening. Not sure what happened there. Do call us back in the studio. The number is 0832-888-401. That's 0832-888-401. If you have anything from the World Cup you'd like to share, especially from a African perspective. Eagle FM, good evening.
Good evening, sir.
Yes, how are you doing today?
Fine, how are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. What would you like to share with us?
What topic is that?
Today we're talking about Africa's participation at this World Cup, about their historic participation at this World Cup.
Okay.
Seeing that, are you following the World Cup?
Yes, I'm following.
Who are you supporting at this World Cup?
Yes?
Who are you supporting at this World Cup?
I'm supporting South Africa.
South Africa. Yeah, do you think they're gonna win tonight against Canada?
Yes, I mean 3-0.
3-0.
Yeah.
It's a bold prediction, but hopefully your prediction does come through. Are there any other African teams that you've been following or been impressed by at this World Cup?
Okay. Just greeting you.
All right. Thank you for calling. Yes, the number in the studio is 0832-888-401. That's 0832-888-401. Leave us a comment on our social media as well. As I said, we are live right now on Facebook. We are live on YouTube. We are live on X. If you leave us a comment on any of those platforms, I will be able to address those comments, those questions, or even those concerns if you happen to have any concerns here on the Eagle Sports Zone. And so, before that commercial break, I was talking about what was happening before a ball was kicked at this World Cup. As I said, this World Cup, before anyone kicked a single ball at this World Cup, Africa already made history because of the number of teams that were participating at this World Cup. But of course, there were a few people that had a problem with this, and a few people that were bold enough to voice their problems with this, and we'll start with Italy's manager, who used to be one of my favorite players, actually, that is Gattuso, who said, and I quote, "In 1994, having two African teams was already enough. First of all," before I continue the rest of the quote, "I wish I had the opportunity to interview Gattuso, because what do you mean by it was already enough?" You know, there's certain things he's alluding to there, but I won't put words in his mouth. Then he went on to say, "Now 9 African nations going to the World Cup feels excessive." My follow-up question to that is, why? Why does that feel excessive? Then he went on to say, "Many won't make any real impact, and FIFA should review this and reduce the slots." Well, Mr. Gattuso, the beautiful thing about the game of football, the beautiful thing about our sport of football, is the talking is done on the pitch. And lo and behold, Africa did in fact make real impact. And that is by having 9 out of their 10 teams qualify for the knockout phase. So maybe Mr. Gattuso should have focused on making sure that his side qualify for the World Cup and not been so worried about the number of slots that Africa has. You know, in fact, the number of slots for Africa should increase. Next World Cup, make it 13. Maybe then, you know, we'll see the Brave Warriors in the World Cup. And you know, speaking of the Brave Warriors, the only African team that didn't make it to the knockout stage of the World Cup was Tunisia. And whose qualifying group was Tunisia in? You guessed it. That is the Brave Warriors. So I don't know if that says something about the Brave Warriors or if that says something about Tunisia. And we also know what happened with Equatorial Guinea in that group. I know if those, let's call it administrative differences, didn't happen, it would probably have been Equatorial Guinea representing Africa from that group and not Tunisia. And who knows, maybe they would have had a better showing than Tunisia. Someone else that had, you know, something to say about Africa's increased number of spots at the World Cup was UEFA president Alexander Seferin, who said, was speaking to Slovenian media, I believe. He said, "We have a lot of matches that are completely uninteresting." And he was referencing the fact that the World Cup has been expanded to 48 teams. So in response to that statement, SAFA, that is the South African Football Association, they released a joint statement that was co-signed by Cape Verde, Curacao, Jordan, Uzbekistan, DR Congo, Haiti, Algeria, Morocco, Egypt, Ghana, Ivory Coast, and Tunisia. Basically denouncing what the UEFA president had to say in regards to the expansion of the World Cup. You know, many people had this opinion of this World Cup, saying that, oh, it's watering down the product. There's too many games. A lot of games won't have any meaning. And those people turn out to be proven wrong. You know, I've had my criticisms of Infantino, that's the FIFA president, in regards to this World Cup. But expanding to 48 teams has been a resounding success, I would say. You know, there's been many fantastic games. I've learned a lot. I didn't know too much about Uzbekistan before this World Cup. I've learned a lot about Uzbekistan. Curaçao, I knew a little about, but from this World Cup, I learned even more. And I know I'm not the only one who went through this process, as we always talk about here in the Eagle Sports Zone, the ability of sport to teach us about things outside of sport. As we always say, sport mirrors what's happening in the world. And this World Cup has been an excellent example of that. And it has been an example of what happens when the smaller nations get an opportunity to participate on this stage as well. And the smaller nations participating on this stage as well gives them access to funding that allows them to develop even more. And in a few moments, we'll talk about the prize money of this World Cup and what it will do for nations like Curaçao, for nations like Uzbekistan. Because remember when Iceland was in the World Cup, that was 2018, I believe. They haven't been back since, but they're an example of what happens when federations, when countries, when governments decide to spend their funds appropriately when it comes to football development. So before we get into that aspect, let's take a listen to what Juan Visa had to say about what this World Cup means to the Congo in general. Oh, actually, first, let's go to Thierry Henry. This is what he had to say about what it means. What Africa's development or Africa's progression in this World Cup means.
World football towards African nations, would you agree?
Yeah, obviously, more teams that are going into this competition allows, obviously, teams to have this type of opportunity. And opportunities, shall I say, even if we think about the amount of African teams are in this competition, but not only African teams. At the end of the day, you were talking about guys that can pick two nations, right? If you go to Africa, we're going to talk about Africa, but you also have with the U.S. Balogun playing for you guys. You have Robinson. We have Michael Olise. That obviously picked France. So that's the way it is. And obviously in Africa. That's the story. I remember back in the days where I grew up, you have a lot of guys coming from different countries, roots, or whatever it is, born and raised in France or in another country. But now, a lot of the countries in Africa are recruiting those guys way earlier. And by the way, it's about the feeling that you have. I have nothing against them. Go and play for whoever you feel like you should play for. And this is what's happening. Coaches are also, you know, like you take MS Faye, the coach of Ivory Coast, was born in France, but he picked to play for Ivory Coast, and he's the coach of Ivory Coast. So, like I said, I know how those teams are and how good they are. The education that I receive is the same education that those guys have received, and it's so nice to see African teams do well.
Thierry,
Yes, there was football legend, football icon Thierry Henry basically echoing what I have been saying here on the Eagle Sports Zone. The gap is closing. The gap is closing. The misconceptions are being broken down. And basically showing us that, you know, when given opportunity, the smaller nations will perform. In Africa in particular, you know, we have a huge, huge pool of talent to choose from, not only on the continent, but in the diaspora as well. You know, the likes of Cape Verde, who majority of their team come from the diaspora. Even Morocco themselves, you know, 2 weeks ago we spoke about Morocco having a full 11 players on the field at one point in their match against Brazil, of the whole squad from goalkeeper to striker not being born in Morocco, but they're representing Morocco at the FIFA World Cup. You know, this is the joke people often make about France, about how their team is basically African. You know, I hear a lot of African people say I'm supporting France because that's basically Africa. So, you know, it's not only Africa that benefits from this. It's something that the sporting world does, the footballing world does. It's something that we need to embrace. You know, and going back to Gattuso, you know, if Italy did the same, you know, embraced people from quote unquote outside, maybe they wouldn't be sitting at home right now. So let's take a listen to what Yohan Wissa, Congo's talisman, who scored Congo's first ever goal at the World Cup in their fixture against Portugal, and then scored two more last night against Uzbekistan, that was, in their 3-1 victory. So let's take a listen to what this World Cup means to DR Congo from a DR Congo player, that is Newcastle United's Yohan Wissa.
Where we go, this company is, you know, we are proud, proud country, we are proud people. We love our country, we love our national team, we love what we want to represent. So I think tonight we just showed that what it means for us is just to fight, no matter what. And, you know, it's not easy in our country, you know, it's a war in East Congo. And every day, every time we wear the shirt, we think about them. So that's why tonight what you show is just to say that, guys, no matter what, we need to keep going because we want peace, you know. And for them, I just say, okay, you know, thank you. Thank you because we came from far, you know, we came from far, from nothing to be here. You know, there's not a lot of story with the black pen, and we need to be proud. So thank you very much for all our Congolese who show up tonight, and especially people at home who has been 2 a.m., who don't sleep, but just waiting for this game. So I want them to be proud, and I would say thank you to them also.
Speaking of 2 a.m., yes. On the continent, Wissa, we are all watching you guys at 2 a.m., 3 a.m., 4 a.m. in the morning. And he was speaking about Congolese people in particular, in specifically Congolese people, but me as an African, as I said, Congo is part of SADC. I feel an immense level of pride. I feel so happy when DR Congo in particular is doing well at this World Cup. You know, them, Cape Verde, all the African countries, but those two in particular, Cape Verde and DR Congo, their World Cup journey has been a joy to watch. I feel like I'm part of those countries myself, simply from what's happening on the football field. But Wissa alluded to something even bigger, you know, how this World Cup is bringing a national pride for the Congolese people in particular, you know, helping them take their minds off any of the struggles that are happening, whether that's in their personal lives or as a country as a whole. He referenced the conflict going on in East Congo. So this is again another example of the power of sport, the power of the World Cup in particular. And we'll be back right on the other side of this.
Do you need toiletries and household cleaners? You won't get it cheaper than a U-Save up to the 7th of June. Get 250 mm jars of Vaseline for only $25 Namibian. Smell fresh with Playboy roll-on deodorant for just $18.99 Namibian. Get 2 kilograms of Surf's hand washing powder for just $49.99 Namibian. Get 750 mm Sunlight dishwashing liquid for $28.99 Namibian. And get 2 boxes of Cares Maxi sanitary pads for only $12.99 Namibian. U-Save. Where else?
Welcome back to the Eagle Sports Zone.
You are now tuned in to the Eagle Sports Zone.
Welcome back to the Eagle Sports Zone. Today we're talking Africa at the 2026 FIFA World Cup, making history on all levels. You know, history was made for Africa at this World Cup before a single ball was even kicked. And now that the knockout stage is upon us, kicking off in about 2 hours, we have Bafana Bafana taking on Canada in the round of 32. And the rest of the round of 32 fixtures, in case you don't know what's happening, after South Africa, Canada, we have Brazil, Japan, then we have Germany, Paraguay, we have Morocco in a tough, tough fixture against the Netherlands, who have been looking good at this World Cup. We have Ivory Coast, the Elephants taking on the Vikings of Norway. That'll be a fantastic fixture as well. Then we have France taking on Sweden. We have Mexico taking on Ecuador. England taking on DR Congo. Can you imagine if DR Congo were to knock out England? That would be fantastic. And Mr. Thomas Tuchel, he shouldn't even get on the plane back to England if DR Congo are able to get a result against England, because I can guarantee you, Mr. Tuchel, you will not be safe. Then we have the Lions of Teranga, who started the World Cup off abysmally. You know, I was coming in supporting Senegal in this World Cup. I thought they would pull a Morocco from 2022, and, you know, reach a semi-final, maybe even a final, who knows? Especially considering that this is probably the last hurrah for their golden generation. For the older guys in their golden generations, I'm talking about your Koulibaly's, I'm talking about your Sadio Mane's, probably even Nicholas Jackson. You know, after this, I don't see them participating in another major tournament. The youngsters will take over. That's your Saz, that's your Ndiaye's. So it'll be a tough test for Senegal, but if they can beat Belgium in the round of 32, then they will be fully back, in my opinion. You know, they got their swagger back against Iraq. As I said, first African country to score 5 goals in a single match in the World Cup. That record now belongs to Senegal. So let's see what the Lions of Teranga can do on. They play their match on Wednesday evening at 10 o'clock in Namibian time. Then we have USA, the host, taking on Bosnia Herzegovina. You have Spain, who many see as favorites, taking on Austria, Portugal, who some people, I don't know why, see as favorites as well. They take on Croatia. Speaking of last hurrah, it's also the last hurrah for Croatia and their golden generation. Should have been their last hurrah, actually. A tournament ago already. And then we have Switzerland taking on Algeria, Australia taking on Egypt, Argentina taking on Cape Verde. And last but not least, the Black Stars of Ghana will be taking on Colombia. So 9 opportunities for Africa to advance to the round of 16 would be a first for many African countries. We can only hope for the best for the continent. Now, before we move on to the prize money and the business of the World Cup, I want us to listen to the perspective of a Nigerian journalist whose name is Victor Opone. He was talking about this historic feat and what it means for African football in general. And this interview, he was giving his thoughts on News Central TV. Let's take a listen.
For African teams, we have 10 of them. One of them has miserably crashed out, which we are happy that they are finally, we've let them off that misery. Tunisia, they failed Africa right there. There's also DR Congo out of the tournament, but DR Congo gave it a fight up until the end. But looking at how Africa performed apart from Tunisia, let's imagine we took 9. Are you impressed with the 9 teams that represented?
Well, of course, the fact that the new format allows for a lot of changes is something that I'm happy that we were able to seize and take control of. The fact that South Africa was able to get out of the group stage for the very first time. The fact that we were also able to see the likes of Morocco, assert their place right there. Egypt getting their very first win. Since appearing in 1934, they had not gotten a win. And then they came to this appearance and they said, you are going to do it no matter what. You know, you see what's in front of you. New system. People are struggling to adapt. Let's go out there. Let's use this opportunity to do something. And I appreciate the fact that some of those countries have been able to do that. I don't think I'll remove Tunisia anyways. It's part of our story. And it's what I always tell people. The dynamics of qualification is always different from tournaments itself. Because, you know, Tunisia were one of the first few to qualify for this World Cup. Right. And everybody felt like they were going to go out there and do something. But, you know, it's a different ballgame entirely. When you go into the World Cup, the qualification run is quite a different kettle of fish out there. So yeah. Kudos to the likes of South Africa, who used, I think they motivated themselves using all of the feedback that they got from other African countries, especially on social media. I noticed that after the first match where they were complaining about it, they readjusted their seat belts and they got better at how they played and got things done. And I think kudos to South Africa for that. Give us more Amapiano. We love it. Kudos to Morocco for, again, asserting what they were able to assert right here at the World Cup, showing us that it's no fluke that they have been there, thereabouts in the last few years. And kudos also to Cote d'Ivoire. They are making the best use of the squad that they have. Shout out to MSFA. It's done brilliantly well. And I think we also have to reckon with Cape Verde. Whatever happens, we know that Cape Verde are one of the biggest stories of this World Cup, and you cannot erase that. They have shown resilience, they have shown beauty, they have shown us that there's magic from one corner of the earth, and I think we should appreciate that as one of the success stories, you know, right there, talking about African countries at the World Cup. Pity that Nigeria is not a part, how do you say it? They're not a part of this particular, you know, Mondial, and it's so sad because we could have gotten our numbers up. Now we have Morocco getting past our record. Now we have Ghana equaling our record. And now we have to answer questions about jollof again.
Our West African brothers, they always humor me. So yes, that just wanted to give you a perspective of... of a fellow journalist on the continent. But now I want to talk about the prize money at this World Cup. It's a historic pool of money, the most FIFA has ever given, naturally, since there are more teams now at the World Cup. And so for those that don't know, every team that participates at the World Cup gets some form of prize money. So even if you go out in the group stage, I'm talking Tunisia, I'm talking Jordan, I'm talking Uzbekistan, I'm talking Scotland, all of you guys that didn't make it to the knockout stages, your minimum prize money allocation is $15 million. Okay? That works out to around 240 million Namibian dollars. So had the Brave Warriors qualified for the World Cup and lost every match 3-0, 3-0, 3-0 in the group stage, they would still have come home with 240 Namibian dollars. Right? That's how much each group stage exiting team is making. If you make it to the round of 32 and you lose in the round of 32, so if Bafana loses to Canada tonight, they are walking away with $17 million. That works out to around 272 million Namibian dollars. You know, if you make it to the round of 16, if Bafana beats Canada tonight and they make it to the round of 16, they walk away with $21 million. That works out to around 336 Namibian dollars. If a team makes it to the quarterfinals, they walk away with $25 million. That works out to around 400 million Namibian dollars. The team makes it to the semifinals. If they finish fourth in fourth place, you know, if Morocco replicates what they did in Qatar, they will walk away with a 33 million Namibian dollars. That works out to around 528 million Namibian dollars. The bronze medalists of the competition, they will walk away with $35 million. That works out to around 560 Namibian dollars. The runners up, so if you make it to the final, you're guaranteed a minimum of $39 million. And that works out to around 624 million Namibian dollars. You know, that's a lot of money. It's a lot of money. And then if you make it to the final and you end up lifting the trophy, you walk away with $56 million. That works itself around plus minus 900 million Namibian dollars. So let's say the Brave Warriors had made it, they would have come back with nearly $1 billion. So the total prize pool for this year's World Cup is $727 million. That works out to around $11 billion. No. It's not a bad, It's not a bad purse to collect. And in addition to the prize money, the prize money figures that I was listing now, that includes a grant that FIFA gave of around 1.5 million that they gave to each team. That's for travel expenses, accommodation expenses, whatever they need to spend it on to prepare themselves. So Tunisia, you're walking away with 15 million. The rest of the continent, that's Senegal, that's Ivory Coast, that's Ghana, that's Cape Verde, that's Egypt, that's Algeria, that's, who did I leave on? That's DR Congo, that's Ivory Coast, that's South Africa. You all walking away with a minimum of 17 million US dollars. So this is what I'm talking about. These are the funds that I'm talking about that help further develop a nation. So in the next cycle of the World Cup, the one that's being hosted in Spain, Morocco, and Portugal, who's to say that they won't be, we won't see Cape Verde again? Cape Verde, by the way, you know, everyone's been captivated by how small Cape Verde is, how miraculous their journey has been, and of course, it's been beautiful to witness, but Cape Verde only lost one game. Cape Verde only lost one game out of 10 in their qualifiers to reach the World Cup. So Cape Verde is here on merit. 100% here on merit. They only lost one game and then they drew two. They finished top of their group. And this was a group that included Cameroon, who aren't at this year's tournament. You know, Cameroon, one of Africa's biggest footballing giants. And that group included Angola as well, who at least in the COSAFA world are a giant as well. So Cape Verde, you know, they aren't a charity case at the World Cup. They're here on merit. They proved why they should be here. And then in the World Cup itself, by the way, they are undefeated at this World Cup. So the next time Cape Verde loses a match at the World Cup will be their first time losing a match at the World Cup. And this is also their first time playing at the World Cup. So right now, as things stand, Cape Verde have played 3 matches at the World Cup. They drew all 3, but they haven't lost. They don't have a loss on their World Cup resume yet. Not a single one. And so hopefully against Argentina, they'll be able to register. Probably if that happens, I'm trying to think in my mind if I can think of any other bigger upsets on the World Cup stage than Cape Verde.
Care that helps you care for others. That's the Basic Mental Health First Aid course, free for NHP members. You'll learn how to spot early signs of mental or emotional distress in friends, family, or colleagues, and how to guide them to the right support before small struggles become bigger problems. Learn more and register for free at nhp.com.na. T's and C's apply. NHP, rooted in care for you.
Your health, your life, your peace of mind. NHP, we're about you.
Lipura nengeno wapubwa eva tere ulikoni maondo tuto ingida ashike kapeno nwe kutite ofoye ekukorile oshafafana nongeshe faili mehola mo ihewe tike kovano hile koshiwala onongeshe faa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi toda njuka okukwetira oipindi konu kwa ndado inawa nune udo otukwetira o special angeta shake ngeshe faa omarudi dayo loka okwane ushendife nawa nokumona oijamo ili nawa ninge Fanona, Monica, Co, Eagle FM, Honore Tatime, Bali Heali, Nola Natu, Heali Bali, No Heali, Ileko, Berewa, Nora Hetatu, Natu, Bali, O Hetatu, Batatu, Oma Felane, Eagle FM, the Eye.
You are now tuned in to the Eagle Sports Zone.
Welcome back to the Eagle Sports Zone. We were talking about Cape Verde's qualification to the 2026 FIFA World Cup, only losing one match in the qualifiers. And captivating the world, really, in terms of how they've been performing at this World Cup. Now, staying on the business of the World Cup, there's something I want to share about sort of how FIFA does business with some of these World Cup hosting cities, or how FIFA does business when they come to your country and say, we have selected you to host the World Cup. Let's take a listen to this report from a
bill for hosting World Cup games. Well, it keeps most of the revenue. How? Through these secretive contracts it signs with host cities. They're often signed with little debate and kept sealed from the public. In Canada, media outlets, including the Globe, have had to use Freedom of Information applications to get these contracts released. Here's what Toronto and Vancouver have agreed to. First, these contracts make it clear that all the revenue from these games go to FIFA, from television income to ticket sales. Even concession sales inside the stadium go to FIFA. That's right, even your hot dog. FIFA expects to generate revenues in excess of $13 billion US from this World Cup cycle. Yet it still requires hosts give it special tax exemptions and insure it against any potential financial losses or lawsuits. Meanwhile, Toronto and Vancouver, along with the federal and provincial governments, are on the hook for major costs. The contracts require hundreds of millions of dollars in upgrades to their stadiums to meet FIFA's strict requirements for its global television broadcasts. Toronto is even installing 17,000 temporary seats so that FIFA can sell more tickets. Outside the stadiums, the cities must spend millions to protect the public and FIFA's trademarks. Bylaw officers will patrol a 2-kilometer-wide radius around the stadiums, looking for anyone trying to cash in on the World Cup who hasn't paid to be a FIFA sponsor. In both cities, it will be the largest police deployment they've ever seen. People who live or work near these sites are going to have to deal with street closures and strict security zones. In Canada, all three levels of government are going to spend more than $1.1 billion to host 13 soccer games. That works out to more than $82 million per game, or almost $1 million for every minute that the World Cup is played in this country. But for some politicians, it's worth it. Hosting the World Cup is a political trophy that brings both global prestige and a boom for the tourism sector. FIFA projects that the tournament could contribute as much as $2 billion to Canada's GDP. Critics, including some elected officials, say these deals are far too one-sided. And they say it's part of the reason that 12 of the last 14 World Cups have lost money for their host nations. All of this raises the question of who really benefits from the World Cup financially and whether the cost of hosting these mega events is really worth it.
There we had a report from Canadian media about, you know, the true cost of hosting a World Cup, how FIFA does business, and things of that nature. But I wanted to play that to give you guys some insight. You know, we've spoken a lot here on the Eagle Sports Zone about Namibia hosting things like AFCON and other various international sporting competitions. And something we don't often think about is it costs money to host these things. And in the academic world, in the sports management academic world, there's been a long-standing discussion or debate on whether actually hosting international tournaments of this magnitude, whether it actually benefits your nation or not. And, you know, I've been fortunate or unfortunate, depending on how you look at it, fortunate enough to having read through some of these studies. And the grand consensus from these academics is there's actually no benefit in a country or a city hosting these mega sporting events. The benefits that people, that the proponents, you know, propose, that is the stimulus of the economy, the added tourism, the amount of money people spend when they come to a country, et cetera, et cetera. All of that stuff, according to the academics at least, and as we heard in that short expert that I played, is pretty much negligible in comparison to what the city spends to bring that there. But now, on the other side of things, there has to be some benefit that makes countries, that makes cities always want to be a host of these major tournaments. And one of the reasons for that, as they alluded to, is political. So, you know, it really depends on who you're asking when it comes to, is it worth it for a country to host these mega events? And of course, it makes more sense for countries like the USA who basically just had to plug and play this World Cup. They didn't have to build much additional infrastructure. I mean, you have world-class teams staying at high schools, having their campsites at high schools in the USA. Not because they don't have other places to stay, but because some of these American high schools are of a world-class standard, right? So there's not many countries in the world that can host major events without really having to add to their national infrastructure, but the USA is one of them. And it is the first time the USA is hosting it since 1994. So it's the first time many, many people, one, are getting familiar with the USA, and many people within the USA are getting familiar with the sport of football, even though they did host it in 1994, as I said. Still surprised that somehow England has only hosted the World Cup once, and that was in 1966. You know, one would think that England would sort of be the home of the World Cup, so to say, but it is the World Cup, so it's good that the world has an opportunity to host the FIFA World Cup. Now we'll look at a report here by the Business of Sports Africa. That's a publication called the Business of Sports Africa. They looked at the numbers of what does it cost for an African to attend the 2026 FIFA World Cup. So what they did is they looked at how much it will cost for a trip to New York, which is where the final will be played in MetLife Stadium. And it's a venue where Senegal and Morocco played majority of their group games. And so this report says that the hotel, the ticket, and the meals cost roughly the same whether you're flying in from Tunis or whether you're flying in from Johannesburg. The one number that moves is the airfare from home. So basically, your cost will change depending on where you're flying from, right? And, the base. So what they're looking at is what it costs for a single supporter on a focus trip. They're using economy for their flights, 5 nights in a mid-range New York hotel, 1 match ticket at the tournament with an average price of $1,065. And before I continue, that's another thing I'm, as great as this World Cup has been, something I'm confused by is how are these stadiums so full and the tickets are so expensive. $1,000 is, let's call it between 16,000 and 18,000 Namibian dollars for a ticket to go watch a football match. And these stadiums have been, for the most part, packed. You know, Qatar World Cup, we saw some empty seats in some of the matches. Here, we're talking about matches like, Jordan against Iran, and matches like that where you would think these are smaller nations. You don't expect the stadium to be as full, but they have been packed. So, I don't know if it's Americans taking up an interest in the sport, or if people from these countries are flying over to watch, or if there's people from the countries living in America, you know, taking the decision to go watch their teams play. But after this World Cup, I would like to further investigate how are people managing to afford their stay in the US and their tickets to these games. And then they said, okay, an average price of $1,065 for the tickets and a modest daily budget for food and the subway, that is the public transport. So, we start with, let's start with Tunisia, right? With Tunisia, the match day ticket, as we said, it will be $1,065 for everyone. Food and transport, $500. A hotel, you're looking at, for 5 nights, you're looking at $1,250. A round trip from Tunis to NYC, that's New York, $540. Algeria, exact same price, $540. You go to Morocco, from Casablanca to New York, $565. Looking at Egypt, now the price is starting to go up. We're looking at $605. If you were traveling from Ghana, that would put you at $760, a round trip flight ticket from Accra to NYC. If you are traveling from Cape Verde, if you are one of the Cape Verdeans attending the 2026 FIFA World Cup, flying to New York for 5 days, you would pay $800. If you're flying from South Africa, surprisingly, not that much more, $840. If you're flying from Senegal, somehow it's cheaper to fly from South Africa to New York than it is to fly from Senegal. I assume that's because there's a direct flight. I don't think there's a direct flight from Dakar to New York. But anyways, that will cost you $880. If you're flying from Cote d'Ivoire, from Abidjan, $970. And if you're flying from the Congo, I think we can expect this one. $1,300 is the flight fare, and that costs, in Namibian dollars, that is around 20, let's call it 21,000 Namibian dollars. So if you were to rank all of these, the most expensive travel package, that is now if we include food, food, transit, if we include the match ticket, and if we include the hotel, the Congolese fans are paying $4,115. And all of this, by the way, is excluding that ridiculous visa fee bond that some of these countries have to pay. I know DR Congo is on that list as well. Our good friend, our favorite, one of our favorite supporters, the guy that mimics the Prime Minister Lumumba, he's only able to attend the matches, whether it's in Canada or in Mexico. The US is not letting him in, right? So that will cost a Congolese fan $4,115. The cheapest on this list is, it's a tie between Tunisia and Algeria. They pay around $3,355. So again, my question is, which Africans, or which people in the world in general, are able to afford to attend this World Cup? Because the prices are astonishing. And it's really catered towards people in high income economies. Or if they're not in high income economies, high earners in whatever respective economy that they are from. I mean, for example, we know that 4,000 is an amount that, actually we can look this up. Let me not estimate. The average monthly salary in the DRC is approximately $50 to $55. So if we're using the price of let's round it off to 4,000. And let's say 55 So on average, according to Wise, on average, a Congolese makes 660 US dollars per year. The person would need to work for over six, save up everything they earn on average, according to Wise, everything they earn for over 6 years to be able to attend the FIFA World Cup. That's how expensive this World Cup has been. Just to put it in, in simple terms for you. Now the number in the studio is 0832888401. That is 0832888401. We will take a short musical break and then we will come back on the other side of this to round up our World Cup discussion. Don't forget you can comment on our social media as well if you'd like to share any comments, questions, or concerns surrounding this World Cup. Let us know who do you think is going to win tonight between Bafana Bafana and Canada. It's the first time for both nations that they're making the knockout stage. So whoever advances will continue to make history in the tournament. And unfortunately for Canada, this match is not taking place in Canada, even though they are a co-hosting nation. This match is taking place in the USA. So it'll be interesting to see what the stadium will look like in terms of supporters. One would think that the Canadians will fill it up, but South Africa has shown up in numbers as well. So we'll see. We'll be back on the other side of this. War Africa, War Africa, War So following up on the spending of FIFA, we're going to listen to a piece by the Business Insider that's going to give you some information as to how much is being spent on the grass that they're playing at the World Cup. And again, this I'm playing this so as Namibians we can get a picture of what it takes to host an international tournament. It's not as simple as having a stadium. There are other things involved. So, here we go.
This 3D printed foot is helping scientists solve one of the World Cup's biggest logistical challenges, making the grass pitch feel the same at every stadium.
We're simulating a 168-pound soccer player, which is the average weight of the last two men's World Cups.
Here at the University of Tennessee, turf grass researcher John Sorokin has spent the last 7 years preparing North America to host the world's biggest sporting event.
A World Cup pitch is one that's going to be uniform, consistent, aesthetically pleasing, and hopefully not talked about at the end of the game.
But that's easier said than done. The 2026 World Cup will be played across 16 cities in Mexico, the United States, and Canada, with different climates, elevations, and stadium designs, all of which affect how grass grows and performs.
Grass is a living organism. You abuse it,
get
it will
ready
die.
To embrace a
and
world
once
of possibilities
the begins,
at the University of Namibia, with a community of ambitious students, researchers, and innovators. Shape your future with a wide range of programs in agriculture, engineering, natural sciences, commerce and management, law, education, human sciences, health sciences, or veterinary medicine. Apply online at unam.edu.na. UNAM, open your mind.
There are no do-overs. The field has to withstand weeks of matches while remaining safe, consistent, and camera-ready for billions of viewers around the world. That's why FIFA has invested more than $5 million into John's grass testing operation. So how is World Cup grass created? And what does it take to keep 16 pitches tournament-ready across three countries? It's a month before the 2026 World Cup kickoff, and John and his staff of more than a dozen researchers are still busy in their Tennessee lab. Since 2021, they've run more than 170 tests to solve a crucial problem. How do you make a field in Vancouver play the same as one in Miami? All World Cup fields have to have a natural grass surface because FIFA wants every pitch to feel the same.
So when a team plays in Miami, for instance, on Bermuda grass, and they go to their next game in Boston on Blue Rye, it's going to be the same feel of foot.
To make that possible, John invented the Flex device, a kind of crash test dummy for soccer fields that measures how firm, consistent, and safe a surface really is.
All 16 stadiums will have one of these.
As the robotic cleat slams into the turf, sensors measure how the surface responds.
And we can go across an entire pitch and look at 77 locations and come up with like a heat map and look at the variability of that surface.
If one area is too soft, too hard, or too slippery, stadium crews can adjust the field before players ever step on it.
The players are going to get hurt no matter what sometimes, but we want to lessen that likelihood that it's a result of the interaction with the surface.
Keeping players safe is only part of the challenge. The ball has to roll and bounce the same way too. Even small differences in the grass can change the speed of the ball or the angle of a bounce, something Argentina's players complained about after a 2024 game in Atlanta. So they use this machine to fire soccer balls at the turf at different speeds and angles, recreating everything from a simple pass to a shot on goal.
Comes in at a 17 degree angle, and we don't want it to come up at more than 14 degree angle, and as it goes in, so as we launch it, what we would normally have is high speed cameras, radar guns.
The measurements help crews fine tune how each field is mowed, watered, and maintained, so the ball comes off the surface at a consistent speed and angle. But keeping the grass the same gets a lot harder when there's no sunlight.
The hardest climates and conditions are going to be the indoor stadiums, right? We have to rely on 100% grow light situations because there's going to be no sunlight to help them grow.
Without natural sunlight, the grass can weaken, recover more slowly, and be less resilient throughout the tournament. To tackle that problem, FIFA helped build this multi-million dollar research facility.
So FIFA built a simulator dome that has grow lights to simulate those five stadiums. So we can grow grass inside with LED lights to simulate the sun.
Each of these 12 bays mimics a different World Cup stadium. Some recreate fully enclosed venues like Atlanta's Mercedes-Benz Stadium, while others replicate partial sunlight conditions like at SoFi in Los Angeles. That helps researchers see how different grasses perform long before they're installed in a World Cup venue. They track things like ball bounce and root health, while soil probes monitor what's happening beneath the surface. And just like at a real World Cup field, they can simulate wear and tear.
If you look down, it's got a roller, and then we put soccer cleat studs on it. And when we go back and forth on the grass, we can simulate the cleat marks in the traffic. And this is how we simulate traffic on our individual plots.
The goal isn't just to figure out which grass grows best. It's to learn how each field should be managed, such as lighting and treatment schedules, and how the pitch will recover between matches. After years of research, the team landed on a game plan. Kentucky bluegrass and ryegrass for cooler climates and indoor stadiums, and Bermuda grass for cities with warmer weather.
Which should be mowed at a slightly lower height, and it grows different than the cool season grass, but they're very common grasses that you might have on a golf course, home lawn, or sports field anywhere. But we've just intensified the management to make it fit for World Cup soccer.
The actual game pitches are grown on 11 farms across North America. They're planted on top of plastic sheets to protect the grass's roots, so they can be transplanted into stadiums.
What happens is the roots hit that plastic and they don't penetrate the plastic, so they grow laterally. This is an example of a small piece of the sod growing on plastic. So this is the green grass on top, and you can see the abundance of roots on the bottom because they couldn't go into below that plastic. So you haven't stressed the plant by cutting off its roots.
Harvesting enough for one pitch takes about a day.
You roll it up off of the plastic and you can cut it like a pizza, and all those roots are intact.
Refrigerated trucks arrive at farms in the middle of the night to avoid traffic. After being harvested in North Carolina, one pitch is hauled 12 hours north to New Jersey. It's headed to MetLife Stadium, home to the World Cup final, which will make it the most scrutinized field in the tournament. In 2022, 1.5 billion people watched the Cup final, roughly 18% of the entire world population. Once the convoy of 27 trucks arrives, workers spend 2 days installing the pitch on top of a base layer of sand, using rakes and asphalt rollers to level and stabilize the surface.
So as it rains, that sand can drain really well.
The following week, a Zamboni-like machine will inject millions of artificial fibers deep into the sand, so the natural grass roots can intertwine with them.
They come in with the machine and stitch in these fibers. They act like rebar to stabilize the sand. 95% of the surface is going to be natural grass, and those fibers are below the canopy of the grass. So when a player runs and slides, they're not touching any of the fibers. There's a lot of layers that go into it. It's kind of like a parfait.
Crews mow daily, monitor moisture, and re-roll the surface after every match.
So if you watch a World Cup game, you'll see just before the game, they'll have the sprinklers on and water the whole field and get the grass wet. They'll turn the irrigation on again at halftime just before the players come out, get the grass wet again. And that helps the ball skip so it doesn't bounce too high. And it helps with the performance playability of the game, the speed of the game, and the quality of the game.
And some of John's students will be there helping manage the fields in person.
We've had a student that started working on this as a high school student. Now he's a freshman at the University of Tennessee. And this summer he's going to go work in Houston for one of the host cities. And that's the nice thing about this is the people that are all involved love what they're doing. It's not work for them. This is a passion.
Now let's take a listen to the technology in the ball, or the overall technology that's being implemented at this World Cup.
This is more than just a game. Every 4 years, the World Cup takes over the globe. The globe. Entire cities transform themselves around the tournament, with hundreds of millions watching. The 2026 FIFA World Cup is unlike any tournament we've ever seen. In this video, we're taking you inside the venues, the equipment, and the tech.
So this is where the chip is being placed.
Changing this tournament forever. I hopped on a flight over to the US, and as soon as we arrived, the producer could not wait to show me what car he'd rented for the trip.
You like it?
That's not right. We can't. It's not very football, is it?
I'm here in Los Angeles, California, checking out the SoFi Stadium. And this is one of 16 venues hosting the 2026 World Cup. And it's definitely the coolest stadium I've ever seen because it's got a f***ing lake. What a start. Should we go and have a look inside? So obviously in the not too distant future, the USA is going to be playing its first game of the World Cup here.
Yes.
How are you feeling about that?
We are ready. This stadium is big. You walk in and you can just sort of see the nudie screen right in front of you. It's 120 yards. It's bigger than a football field. Over 70,000 square feet, double-sided halo. We have speakers hidden inside the Infinity screen that cover the whole stadium. That black that you see there is actually fabric. Behind it is all the speakers. An audio team that's supporting everything you hear in the stadium.
With everything from NFL to Monster Jam being hosted here, it's Josh's team's responsibility to make the stadium experience one to remember. And I have to say, when I walked in for the first time, the Infinity display blew my mind. Imagine being sat up there. A massive two-sided display with 80 million pixels floating right there in the middle of the stadium. How does this thing work? I had to find out.
So the Infinity screen is broken up into a bunch of nodes, and these are all servers that are appearing on the screen. 16 nodes all playing back video at the exact same time in sync to put that whole screen together. You can see those different nodes and how the screen is broken up. So if any one of these fails, you've got the backup to switch over to. If multiple nodes fail, we have a whole entire backup system.
I noticed there's a graphic here, which I assume is the roof.
That is the roof. So the roof is also an LED screen.
Yeah.
It is over 750,000 square feet, biggest screen in the world. It's 28,000 pixels, which if you're flying in an airplane, great view, and you get to see whatever graphic we put up there.
And speaking of good views, what about that pitch? Especially with ticket prices being so damn high. It turns out that creating a World Cup-worthy pitch at SoFi Stadium is no small feat. Because the permanent NFL synthetic turf is too narrow for international football, engineers have literally built an entire new pitch right on top of it, raising the surface by almost 3 feet. And to create the extra width that FIFA demands, SoFi Stadium has temporarily removed hundreds of its lower pitch-level seats. Underneath is a high-tech drainage and aeration system, followed by carefully leveled layers of sand. On top of that, almost 28,000 square feet of premium grass, complete with a full irrigation setup. And because SoFi Stadium's roof blocks natural UV light, LED grow lights bathe the pitch in a signature pink glow to keep the grass healthy. The grass itself is a special Kentucky bluegrass and rye mix. It's grown in Washington and then shipped to LA in refrigerated trucks for installation. And this is the result. One of the most advanced temporary pitches ever built for football's biggest stage.
Watching football live from a screen is such a normal part of our lives that we don't even think about it these days. 100 years ago, if you wanted live updates on how a sporting match was going, you'd have to turn on the radio and hope that a man in a box with a microphone was doing a good enough job of explaining what was going on with his words. The first game to be televised live occurred in September 1937, and although this was a huge moment in broadcast history, it definitely wasn't 4K, nor did they have the same number of camera angles that we're used to enjoying these days. In 2026, we have the luxury of box lenses with incredible zoom, spider cameras that float around the venue, and even POV views from the referees themselves. And this is all used to bring us all closer to the action. So what would the atmosphere in this room be like during a live game?
First of all, it's very loud. I mean, the best thing in the world, you sit in here and you put something up on the screen and you hear 70,000 people cheer, respond, boo, or do whatever to whatever you put up there. And it's like you're getting that live feedback. Now you know that they liked it or not. We have a replay team here watching every play. They're getting those replays up there within seconds.
Ah, yes, replays. Of course, one of the things that we all use to settle arguments. But more importantly, they're used for officiating games to keep things fair. With 22 players and a football all moving around the pitch at the same time, it's near impossible to see everything that's going on. So what do we do about that? Well, we use everyone's favorite bit of football technology, VAR.
Scrap VAR!
I don't understand it.
Because it's worthless, pointless, a total waste of time.
I don't think VAR gets involved. That's a joke. I'm going about VAR this, VAR that.
And the VAR is too many mistakes.
A team of VAR officials review footage from more than 24 cameras positioned around the stadium. This gives refs a more accurate picture of what's happening on the field versus their single point of view somewhere on the pitch. Refs can review and feedback footage from multiple angles to make sure their calls are as accurate as possible. That's until now, because there's another acronym on the block, and this is SAOT, which stands for semi-automated offside technology. Making its debut at the Qatar World Cup in 2022, this technology has fundamentally changed the way games are tracked and refereed. About a dozen high-speed cameras dotted around the stadium track 29 data points per person on the field, creating digital skeletons and making sure that no one's got anywhere to hide. This data is then combined with a tiny sensor found inside the ball, which transmits its exact position about 500 times a second. This information is all fed into an AI system, which builds an exact, real-time 3D model of the field and its players. It can tell if a player's knee, foot, or cheeks are offside by millimeters. But the technology doesn't just stop with fancy cameras. This ball is actually the most advanced ever used at a World Cup.
We touched on it earlier, but I wanted to learn more about this computerized ball. What does it actually do?
Purpose of it really is around making the game more fair. In the modern game, VAR is a reality, right? You're often faced with situations where even the ref stands on the sideline, spends multiple minutes trying to detect an offside situation. This is something where the ball comes in handy and provides a automatic calibration to the exact moment the pass is being played. Again, this is something where already at the 22 World Cup, we were able to decrease the time spent in front of the monitor versus refereeing the game by more than 70%. We're not taking away any decision rights from the referees or making that call for them, but we're providing them more reliable information to make the right calls.
Now, I have my own kind of consumer try under, but I know that there's no chip in here. So I wonder if you're able to show us kind of what it actually looks like.
So this is where the chip is being placed, right on the side of that bladder. It's opposite the valve. So we've got this counterbalancing that is simulated with our engineering experts. So from this first like step from simulation into materialized prototype, we achieved a perfectly counterbalanced bladder and therefore also counterbalanced ball. This is the most tested Adidas ball out there. We've got this robot behind me here, our best, our most accurate shooter, to really understand, is this thing really performing to the maximum standard? And the robot can shoot harder than anybody else in the world. It's maybe like a Marvel character could achieve, but not a human being on the pitch.
Kind of unbelievable to imagine that a player wouldn't be able to notice a change in the behavior of the ball. So what are we doing to kind of compensate for this additional payload stuck to one side of the ball?
Up to this stage, no.
You can have a good evening. Hello?
Hello?
Yes, I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing good.
Yes, what would you like to share with us today?
We are on Eagle FM Sport.
Yes.
African countries
are there qualified for the Luna Cup thing?
Nine of the ten countries qualified. Which one is not qualified?
It's just Tunisia.
Oh, just Tunisia.
Yes.
Maybe we hope that together we'll do it today again.
Yeah, they are playing now at nine. Is that who you are supporting, South Africa?
I'm supporting South Africa and Morocco.
Okay. Yeah, let's hope Bafana can do it.
Maybe they can do it.
Yeah.
Because I check the Canadians, they're not really strong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Alright, then.
Thank you for calling.
Alright.
Yes, the number in the series is 0832-888-401, 0832-888-401. South African supporter there. Chiming in with his thoughts. And you know, speaking of South Africa, this World Cup kind of, it proved what I already suspected, but I didn't have the evidence to support my belief, my hypothesis. My hypothesis was that, yes, the Springboks back-to-back world champions in rugby, the best rugby team for the past, let's say, 10 years, one of the best rugby teams, federations ever, you know, a staple in the rugby world. Literally one of the world's best, right? And they happen to be in South Africa. And we always see when it's World Cup time, when it's Springbok time, whenever they even just have an international friendly or something, we see it even here in Namibia, how how much support they get. We see the South African flags, we see the Springbok jerseys, we see the stuff online, but my hypothesis has always been, if we lived in a world where both Bafana Bafana and the Springboks were equally as good, or if Bafana Bafana had the amount of opportunities on the international stage that the Springboks have, and of course the Springboks have those opportunities because they are that good, you know, they created those opportunities for themselves. So I'm not saying that Springboks have an advantage. What I'm saying is, when it occurs that South Africa is on the global stage when it comes to football, and we know what rugby has done for South Africa in a literal historical sense. We know what Nelson Mandela did with the Rugby World Cup, right? On the cusp of South Africa's independence. So we're not taking anything away in that regard. But I still believe, and I think this World Cup is proving that, I still believe that Bafana Bafana is not only South Africa's team, okay, let's say SADC's team. Most Southern Africans claim Bafana Bafana as their own. And we're seeing now in the World Cup, we see why. But the scenes that I've seen from South Africans when it comes to celebrating Bafana Bafana, you know, we saw people celebrating, dancing, screaming, crying at 4 or 5 in the morning when they qualified for the knockout stage. You know, I'm watching, well, I'm reading accounts of how much joy Bafana Bafana is bringing to the people of South Africa, how much unity it's bringing to the people of South Africa. And of course, rugby does the same, but I think Bafana Bafana does it at an even higher level. That's been my hypothesis during this incredible run from the Springboks. So yes, we shouldn't compare the two, of course. You know, they can coexist. We don't always have to choose one over the other. But for the purpose of this conversation, I 100% think, and if Bafana Bafana wins tonight, we're going to see things from South Africa we've never seen before. I can promise you that. We're going to see things that we've never seen before. Never seen before when the Springboks won the World Cup 2 times in a row now. Never seen before when Nelson Mandela was doing what he was doing with rugby. If Bafana Bafana manages to win tonight and advance to the round of 16 of the FIFA World Cup, I'm sure even here in Namibia, we're going to, what time will the match end? The match will probably end, let's call it 11. That's if it doesn't go to extra time. Eagle FM, good evening. Can you speak up? I can't quite hear you.
Okay. Can you please put me off air?
Off air?
Yeah.
Are you aware that you're calling Eagle FM?
Yes.
Okay. I'll take you off in just a moment.
Lipura nengeno wapumbwa eva tere ulikoni maondo tuto ingida ashike kapeno meku tete opoe ekukurile oshafafana nongeshefa ili meholamo iho etike kovano hile koshuala unongeshefa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano okupitiramo Eagle FM otuna evi tota njuka okukwetira oipindi konu konda doi inawa nuneudo otukwetira o special ange tashake ngeshefa omarudi dayo loka opone ushendife nawa nokumona oijamo ili nawa inge pata fanona monika ko Eagle FM onmora itatu imwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali ile ko mberewa mora hetatu natu bali o hetatu batatu o mafelane Eagle FM VI.
The World Cup isn't just a football tournament. It's a logistical masterpiece. Behind one kickoff is 4 years of planning, billions of dollars, the machinery of an entire global governing body, and an operation so vast it reshapes the economies of entire nations. Unlike the Super Bowl, which is American and stays American, the World Cup belongs to no one and everyone simultaneously. Every 4 years, it lands somewhere different. A different continent, a different culture, a different set of stadiums. And somehow it works. Somehow, 48 nations, 104 matches, millions of traveling supporters, 5 billion viewers, and a prize fund pushing $1 billion all collide into the most watched sporting event in human history. So, how does it actually happen? In this video, we're breaking down how the FIFA World Cup really works. From host country selection, the ticket lottery that processed over 500 million requests, to a broadcast operation worth nearly $4 billion. The sponsorship empire, security, the brand new halftime show set to transform the World Cup final, and the thousands of people working behind the scenes to make football's biggest event possible. Let's get into it. To understand the World Cup, you first have to understand FIFA. Founded in 1904 with just 7 member associations, FIFA today governs 211 national federations, more members than the United Nations. It is, by any measure, the most powerful single sport governing body on Earth, and once every 4 years, it points out everything it has at one tournament. The financial scale is almost incomprehensible. For the 2022 Qatar World Cup, FIFA generated $7.5 billion in revenue from a single event cycle. FIFA's revised budget for the 2023-2026 commercial cycle targets $13 billion in total revenue. The 2026 World Cup alone is projected to generate approximately $8.9 billion, driven by record broadcasting deals, a sold-out sponsorship portfolio, as well as a completely new ticketing structure for the 104-match tournament, which will be played across 16 cities in North America. To put that into perspective, the NFL generates roughly $20 billion in annual revenue across an entire season. 272 regular season games, 32 franchises, one of the most lucrative sports leagues ever built. FIFA is targeting $13 billion from a single 4-year cycle. And unlike the NFL, which has permanent franchises in permanent cities with decades of infrastructure in place, the World Cup has to be rebuilt from scratch in a new corner of the world every single time. That's the miracle nobody talks about. It starts not with a whistle, but with a vote. The bidding process for the World Cup begins a decade before the first ball is kicked. Nations, sometimes coalitions of nations, submit formal bids to FIFA outlining their stadium infrastructure, transport plans, accommodation capacity, security frameworks, and financial guarantees. It is, effectively, a job interview, where the prize is one of the largest economic injections a country can receive. The 2026 tournament, a joint bid from the United States, Canada, and Mexico, was awarded in 2018. It was the first World Cup ever staged across 3 nations simultaneously, with 11 cities in the United States, 3 in Mexico, and 2 in Canada. 16 host cities, 3 national football associations, 3 governments, 3 different legal systems, currencies, and transportation networks, all synchronized under the FIFA banner. Previous hosts have had to build from almost nothing. Qatar constructed 8 brand new stadiums for 2022, including one made entirely from repurposed shipping containers. Brazil spent over $11 billion on infrastructure for 2014. South Africa built new stadiums in 2010 that some would argue the country never truly needed after the tournament ended. The economics of hosting are complicated, contested, and almost never fully resolved before the opening ceremony begins. Face value pricing structure for 2026 ranged from $60 for early group stage matches to more than $35,000 for the most exclusive packages for the final at MetLife Stadium in New Jersey. But here's where it gets remarkable. FIFA, for the first time, allowed open resale pricing on its official marketplace. The result was immediate and spectacular. The cheapest final tickets on the secondary market quickly climbed to between $8,000 and $9,775, just to get into the building. Premium, lower bowl seats near the pitch were listed at $15,000 to $38,000, and some of the most exclusive final tickets were reportedly listed for more than $2 million. The average tracking price for a final ticket across all sections settled around $11,272. For comparison, the average resale price for a Super Bowl ticket in recent years has hovered between $8,000 and $10,000, and that's considered extreme. The Super Bowl is one city, one game, one Sunday. The World Cup final is one city, one game, one Sunday, and it costs the same to get in, except the audience watching at home is 12 times larger. And FIFA charges both the seller and the buyer a 15% fee on its official marketplace. They are, in the most literal sense, monetizing the mania they've created. You enter the lottery, you take your chances, and if you miss out, you pay the market rate, which is, at this tournament, whatever the market decides to charge. FIFA expects to generate approximately $4.3 billion from broadcasting rights for the 2026 World Cup cycle alone. That is a 43% increase on Qatar 2022. Media rights revenues for 2026 are projected at $3.8 billion, up 22% from the previous tournament, with deals covering more than 190 territories globally. In the United States, Fox Sports and Telemundo hold the rights in a deal valued at approximately $1.25 billion, covering both English and Spanish language audiences. The contrast with the NFL is instructive. An NFL broadcast on a Sunday afternoon runs close to 20 minutes of advertising per hour. Games are structured around commercial breaks, two-minute warnings, timeouts, replay reviews, all of them monetized. The World Cup has no commercial breaks during the 45-minute halves. None. Sponsors get their exposure through perimeter boards, kit deals, and pre- and post-match slots. But the 90 minutes of football itself is uninterrupted. The product is protected. The 2022 World Cup final between Argentina and France drew 1.5 billion viewers. Not 1.5 billion households, 1.5 billion individual viewers for a single match. Across the full tournament, FIFA estimates 5 billion people engaged with the event in some form. FIFA President Gianni Infantino has already described the 2026 edition as 104 Super Bowls in 1 month. The Super Bowl draws around 127 million viewers. The World Cup final beats that number by a factor of 12. With an audience that size, the sponsorship structure is something different altogether. FIFA's marketing and sponsorship rights are projected to deliver between $2.5 and $3 billion for the 2026 cycle, a 152% increase over the Qatar cycle's equivalent figure. The sponsor roster is tiered. At the top sit FIFA's global partners, Adidas, Coca-Cola, Visa, Hyundai/Kia, and Wanda Group. Below them are World Cup-specific sponsors, Budweiser, McDonald's, Qatar Airways, Frito-Lay, Bank of America, Verizon, and Marriott Bonvoy, among others. The shift for 2026 is the American footprint. US-based brands now account for 52% of World Cup sponsorship revenue, up from 36% in Qatar 2022. DoorDash and Bank of America were among the companies that secured fresh sponsorship deals or strengthened existing commitments tied to the North American edition of the tournament. When the World Cup moved to American soil, American money followed. Unlike the NFL, where sponsors buy 30-second spots during games watched primarily by one nation, World Cup sponsors are playing a completely different game. They want volume across every continent. They want the Brazilian grandmother watching in Sao Paulo, the 12-year-old in London, the die-hard supporter in Buenos Aires. A Super Bowl ad slot costs around $7 million for 30 seconds and reaches roughly 127 million viewers. A World Cup sponsorship package reaches 5 billion. Before a single player steps onto the pitch, a different tournament has already been played and won. Adidas and Nike have contested the World Cup kit and ball market for decades. Adidas has supplied the official match ball to every World Cup since 1970. The Telstar, the Tango, the Jabulani, and the Brazuca. Each ball is an event in itself, a product launch timed to a global audience. Adidas pays for this exclusivity as part of its FIFA partner deal. It is one of the most valuable recurring contracts in commercial sport. Meanwhile, Nike, without ever being an official FIFA partner, has for years outfitted more national teams than Adidas. In 2022, Nike kitted 13 of the 32 competing nations, Adidas just 8. Their goal isn't simply to sponsor the tournament. It's to align themselves with the players and national teams that capture the world's attention. While the commercial machine runs in the background, 48 national squads are building micro-civilizations. Each team is assigned a base camp, a hotel, training complex, and support infrastructure that becomes home for potentially 7 weeks. The logistics of a modern national football squad are staggering. Nutritionists, physios, sports psychologists, analysts, kitmen, chefs, media officers, security personnel. Some national associations travel with 80 or 90 staff members alongside the 26-man playing squad. The training facilities must meet FIFA's minimum specifications. A full-size grass pitch, access to medical facilities, press conference infrastructure. In 2022, Qatar built or upgraded dozens of training sites within close proximity to the stadiums. For 2026, base camp selection has been a major logistical exercise across 16 cities, spread over 3 countries and thousands of kilometers. The World Cup is classified as the highest tier of international security events, requiring cooperation between FIFA's own security division, local law enforcement, and military assets. In Qatar 2022, over 15,000 security personnel were deployed across match venues on any given match day. The country also deployed drones, AI-powered surveillance cameras, coastal naval patrols, and a no-fly zone over stadium districts on match days. For the 2026 tournament in the United States, the coordination becomes even more complex. The FBI, Department of Homeland Security, Secret Service, and 16 different city and state law enforcement agencies will all need to synchronize. FIFA begins security planning no fewer than 4 years in advance. Threat assessments are conducted continuously. Stadiums undergo security audits. And for every single match, there are dedicated emergency response protocols involving medical, fire, and counter-terrorism units. The scope of this is something most fans never think about, but it's one of the most resource-intensive parts of the entire operation. For the fans, a World Cup match lasts 90 minutes. For everyone else, it begins before sunrise. Hours before the gates open, stadium operations teams are already at work. Security checkpoints are tested. Communication systems are checked. Medical teams are briefed. Thousands of volunteers take their positions. You don't pull off a tournament of this scale with paid staff alone. Qatar recruited approximately 20,000 volunteers for the 2022 World Cup, drawn from over 160 nationalities. These volunteers handled fan assistance, wayfinding, transportation coordination, language support, media logistics, and venue hospitality. Catering staff prepare tens of thousands of meals and drinks. Groundskeepers inspect every inch of the pitch, measuring grass height and checking the condition of the surface one final time. Then come the broadcasters. A modern World Cup match is one of the most technologically complex live productions on Earth. Hundreds of cameras are installed throughout the stadium. Spider cams glide above the pitch. Commentary teams arrive from every corner of the globe. Audio engineers, producers, replay operators, graphics teams, and technicians work from temporary control rooms that resemble miniature space stations. By kickoff, thousands of people are involved in producing a single match. The teams themselves arrive according to meticulously planned schedules. Team buses move under police escort. Security routes are cleared in advance. Arrival times are coordinated down to the minute. A delayed team bus can create a domino effect across stadium operations, broadcasting schedules, and security procedures. Unlike the Super Bowl's halftime show, which happens mid-game, the World Cup's signature performance moment is the opening ceremony before the first match. This is a globally televised spectacle produced by FIFA in collaboration with the host nation's organizing committee. It typically lasts around 30 to 40 minutes and serves as the country's cultural statement to the world. These ceremonies are genuinely consequential moments for host nations. They're often a country's largest cultural export in a generation. A chance to define how the world sees you. Brazil's 2014 ceremony showcased its biodiversity and music. Russia's 2018 ceremony leaned into classical Russian cultural heritage. The pressure to get it right is enormous. At Qatar 2022, the opening ceremony was headlined by Morgan Freeman, BTS star Jungkook, and Qatari singer Fahad Al-Kubaisi. The spectacle combined traditional Qatari culture, hundreds of performers, elaborate visual effects, and addresses from both FIFA president Gianni Infantino and Qatar's emir, creating one of the most talked-about opening ceremonies in World Cup history. For nearly a century, the World Cup followed a simple formula. 45 minutes of football, 15 minutes of rest, another 45 minutes of football. But in 2026, FIFA is changing that tradition. For the first time in World Cup history, final will feature a dedicated halftime show inspired by the spectacle of events like the Super Bowl. What was once a brief period for players to recover and coaches to make tactical adjustments is now being transformed into an entertainment event in its own right. The challenge is obvious. Unlike the Super Bowl, where halftime can stretch well beyond 30 minutes, football's halftime interval is tightly regulated. The pitch must remain playable. Players still need their dressing room time. Broadcasters need their analysis windows. And millions of viewers expect the match to resume on schedule. That means every second of the production must be choreographed with military precision. Stages must be assembled and removed in minutes. Audio systems have to be installed without damaging the playing surface. Performers, equipment, technicians, and production crews must enter and exit the stadium in an operation timed almost to the second. Because while the world is watching the show, another countdown is ticking in the background. The moment 22 players have to return to the pitch and resume the biggest match in world football.